We camped out. Now, you could go and stay in hotels, such as they were, in the bigger cities like Zagreb and Ljubljana and even in Skopje. In Sarajevo, the hotel would be passable. Mm-hmm. But anywhere in the sticks, hotels were terrible. And bed bugs is by the million. So, you know, it just wasn't worth your life to go there. And I remember going to a hotel one night when we thought we were really stuck. And we went there, and I had to explain my case and to the chief of police. And he took me around to this hotel, and it was a small town. It was only about 10,000 people in the country. Mm-hmm. And down in the south. And there they were. There were two dormitories, and all they were mats on the floor. One was for women, one was for men. And these mats looked as though they'd been there for 100 years. They're all greasy and that.
Just lying on the floor.
Just on the floor, and it's all just rows of them, and there's people all in all disarray, and all in their clothes, of course. The way they sleep there, they don't get undressed at night.
And you stay there the night?
No, we didn't. We said, no, we're going to sit up in the vehicle all night because she's not going to sleep in there. She wouldn't have the right to order.
Yeah, I would have suggested the car, actually.
We just sat up in the car all night.
I guess in the summer, if it's warm, it doesn't matter. You could sleep outside in tents or in sleeping bags.
Yeah, well, we either used a tarp or, because my predecessor didn't have a tent, he just borrowed a tarp on everyone to go, which wasn't very often.
Mm-hmm.
But
his wife didn't.
No, his wife didn't do it. But eventually I got a tent and we used that. And but one of the big disadvantages of staying in a hotel was that when you arrived in the hotel, before you get a room, you had to hand in your passport.
Yes.
And then you couldn't go until they gave you back your passport, of course. Actually, it's in their country, it's you have an identity card, not your diplomatic passport, but an identity card, which is called a Lichna Karta. What it means, I really don't know, but it's your identity card.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, as soon as you did that, why, the local police knew who you were and so on, and they would wire or phone Belgrade and say you got that far and were there the next day and so on and so on.
So they keep tabs on you pretty good.
And then when you approached the barracks in the town maybe the next day and so on, where they'd all be waiting for you up there, watching to see if you were taking pictures and things like that. But they knew where you were all the time if you stayed in a hotel.
Well, tell me, if you were, say, stopped by police on a road or at a campsite, would they have a right to ask for your identification card?
Oh, yeah.
And would they do that on a consistent basis?
If they stopped you, yeah, they would, sure. Oh, yeah, the first thing you see it in the streets, they just walk up to any civilian and say, if it's the card. They're doing it all the time. The police, feel they got to be doing something.
Yeah, and I suppose your Chevrolet was a distinctive car in Yugoslavia.
Oh, yeah, and it had the diplomatic license on it.
Yeah.
And they knew that.
And what block you belong to.
Each country had a different set of license numbers, so they could tell what country you were, sort of thing. Well, suffice to say that we didn't stay in hotels very much, except during the winter time when it was too cold to camp out, or the snow was too deep, kind of thing.
Would you go on trips during the winter as often as during the summer?
Not quite as often, but generally speaking, the south of the country, you could travel all winter long because you didn't have snow down there. It was a very arid country.
Mm-hmm.
The north of the country, up in Slovenia, you get 2 and 3 foot drifts.
Yeah.
So you couldn't do them very well in the wintertime, although we did one tour. We spent numerous days in Ljubljana and Zagreb, and we tour out each day, make a different sort of a clover leaf each day from there, and come back to the same hotel each night.
Mm-hmm.
But we had the Jeep with a four-wheel drive, there's no snow clearance or anything. And one of the disadvantages, you had to unload everything out of the Jeep at night and carry it all up to your hotel room.
Because it's open.
Because, they would have gone over everything there was and examined it also. And your food would have frozen and all that sort of thing. You had canned food and all that. However, we did it. But we used army fatigue clothing. I got that before I went out there for both her and myself. It was just army fatigues.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we wore when we traveled. Because everything was so dirty and dusty in the summertime and muddy and
so there were no paved roads and parts?
There were very few paved roads. In fact, there's only one major paved road, and that was from Belgrade up to Ljubljana and on to Trieste. The rest of them were practically all just stone roads, that is, crushed gravel.
Mm-hmm. Hard on tires, I should think.
Oh, the horseshoe nails has got the tires.
He knew how to patch tires, too.
So did she.
I don't know now, though.
We had eight tires. No, four tires after dinner one night. We were driving together, supper, and after. And before 10 o'clock, we had four flats. We had to stop. We used to carry a whole stack of tubes, you see, and just change tubes until we'd run out of them. We lived on canned food on those trips.
Would you have a stove with you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had all the gear. We only bought the black bread. You could buy that locally, black bread, and we bought eggs. Mm-hmm. The only things we bought when we traveled.
Well, why would you trust the black bread and not other things?
Well, we couldn't get anything else to eat.
Towards the end of the time, we could get white bread in some places.
Some
yeah.
big cities, yeah.
Yeah, but...
Well, black bread, you can't live too long without some bread. Everything's concentrated in tins and that, you know.
Always hardtack or whatever they have in the room, maybe.
Yeah, well, I'd rather have black bread than hardtack myself.
And their black bread tasted malty or something, didn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it really did. It was chewy. Oh, boy. It'd take a long while to chew your way through it.
Did you ever think that was perhaps the wood chips that might have been in it?
I don't know. Well, it was all made very primitively.
Another thing you said about the dust. The dust smelled. It had a nasty smell. I don't know if it was the animals
or what. Using the road, you know, the oxen and...
And I broke out in a rash one time. Yeah. I was wearing shorts and just the dust
was terrible in the summertime. We did trips anywhere from one day out and back the same day to Belgrade up to 14 days on the road steadily. And we averaged, I think, once... If you were doing... going to the towns on the way to check out the barracks. They're very seldom on the main street, so you'd have to drive around the back streets and find it first.
Mm-hmm.
If you knew where it was, you just automatically drove past.
Would they tend to be in the same place in all towns and cities?
No system there. But if you were checking like that, driving around the country, we'd seldom make 300 kilometers a day.
Mm-hmm. The roads are so bad.
Roads were bad, and there were so many traffic jams with sheep across the road and things like that. All you do is wait.
Somebody dumped a load of hay.
Yeah, somebody load of hay got stuck there. They wait till they moved the hay.
And an avalanche or a what do you call that? Yeah,
it
was a gravel.
Yeah, gravel. No, rock fly.
Rock fly.
Let me ask you this: when you did find a barrack, and I think it's in an enclosed area, what would you do?
Well, very often they only had barbed wire around them, and you would spot that there was a soldier on duty. They always had a sentry up front.
Yes.
So that was a pretty good giveaway. And or approaching the town, if you're driving around the town, you might find a stack of hay out there somewhere. Well, if there was a sentry box beside it, you know, like they have at Buckingham Palace,
mm-hmm.
for a soldier in it, that meant it was a military...
installation.
There'd be a military unit in the town, and that was their... haystack for their horses. So you knew there was one there and there was something worthwhile finding.
Okay, but once you found it, what would you do?
Well, the most you could do was drive past. If you got out and tried to walk past, you'd have a whole flock of people with you in no time at all because you're a curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they would have made life pretty unpleasant for you.
Well, what sort of information could you gauge from it? Other than the fact there was a unit there?
Yeah, well, you can get... First of all, very often you can look into the parade ground and you'd see they had guns lined up.
Mm-hmm.
You could tell whether it was a horse drawn, it had horses in it. And you could tell very often what the unit was like by even driving around the town and seeing soldiers walking around and seeing their shoulder badges and what corps they belonged to, what arm.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was a headquarters at all, there was an officer on duty as a sentry.
Mm-hmm.
So you knew it was at least a brigade headquarters, or an armored division, or a divisional headquarters, or a brigade headquarters, if there was an officer on duty.
Mm-hmm.
And then if there were any wireless masts sticking up anywhere, you knew it was a bit of a headquarters. And things like that, and sometimes you'd see troops drilling in the parade ground.
Mm-hmm.
If it was a medical unit, why, their carts that their horses pulled were all had red crosses on them. Generally speaking, there were a darn few units you could go past without knowing what kind of a unit was in there. Mm-hmm. And very often the size of it, too, by the size of the barracks and the just the number of soldiers there and so on. It was pretty easy to do once you put all these crews together.
Mm-hmm. Now, would you be writing all this down? Would you feel safe enough to do that?
Well, she'd do the writing, and usually she'd have something she could pull over here if anybody came and booked her head in the door.
Yeah. Would the police, if they say they stopped you...
Oh, they'd ask for your book, yeah, right. If they saw you making a note, they'd ask for your book and grab it. Mm-hmm. So, I must say that we had almost no trouble with that kind of security. Now, the British and Americans were having it all the time.
Well,
I think they were careless.
Yeah, I think you were very careful.
For one thing, if there was a barracks up a dead end, I would no more think of taking a picture of it on the way in. And the man on the moon, I might take a picture on the way out, but not on the way in and come back and find a guy in the middle of the road with his banner fixed. Well, that's what some of these guys did. And
this common sense approach would dictate that you wouldn't do that.
Holy smokes, yeah. But,
You must admit, Britisher than the American officers tend to be rather arrogant. Or as a race, they tend to be more arrogant than we do.
Well, some of them were smart enough, but damn it, they did their funny things. They were just careless, didn't think. And, well, I don't know. They never seemed to be able to... Dickie Bird, his wife was writing down the stuff, and the guy reached in the window to grab her notebook, you see. She threw it over to Dickie Bird. He grabbed it. They tried to grab him. This is while they're both in the front seat of their Land Rover. They threw it back to her. And, well, this is no way to try and treat the security forces. Well, they grabbed the two of them, yanked them out of the vehicle. And they were in for a rough time there for a while, but they deserved it, I thought. You're silly thing like that. She should have had that out of sight as soon as they stopped or anything, you see. But we never had any problems like that. I don't know if they gave me any credit for it. I think they still knew that we were what we were up to.
Yeah.
I don't think they were naive about what we were doing, but
they appreciated some with a bit of skill, I suppose.
I think so. But, gas stations. Well, this was a great problem because you got these coupons, but how to find anywhere there was gas stations? Sometimes it would be. Usually it was just a tank.
Yeah.
No self-serve, no...
gosh. Well, I think in Zagreb and in Ljubljana and in Sarajevo, they had a gas station in the middle of town. One for everybody.
Mm-hmm. And there was one out in the middle of the auto put.
There was one halfway up the auto put when we left, not when we first got there.
No, that's right.
But that was halfway between Belgrade and Zagreb. But the rest of them, it would just be a tank somewhere. And it was very great importance to find out where these were before you went on your tour. And the attachés used to exchange information on where they'd found a gasoline supply. Mm-hmm. And we had a very great list of these.
Like barrels.
Sometimes they were just barrels. One time, it was in Sarajevo, of all places. The main one downtown had run out of gas. So they directed me out, and they filled me out of a pipe out of a railway car, a railway tank car. Well, it was a great problem. I used to carry up to 5 jerry cans of extra gas with me on the top of the car in order to be able to, and in the Jeep, stored in the Jeep.
It's a dangerous way of traveling, isn't it?
Oh, gosh. Well, we were pretty well self-contained. We had to carry our own water.
But from what you told me of the gasoline, I should think that it was so heavily diluted down that even if you had a match, it might not have gone off.
Well, that's what they always said.
We had to get some Bardol to put in, didn't we?
To make it burn, yeah.
Did it really?
Couldn't use it in the gasoline stove at all. We used to burn alcohol in our stove because you couldn't get... The alcohol was cheap as heck. Mm-hmm. Nobody used it there. I don't know why. You go down and buy a gallon of alcohol and go in the dollar. Well, we always camped at dusk at last light because no matter where you camp, peasants would come around by the millions. You can be out in the middle of what looked like a desert and nobody around. And within 5 minutes, there a whole flock of them there. I don't know where they come from.
Trying to get stuff from you?
No, they would stand there and look at you. and stand watch your every mouthful.
If you started to talk to them, they wanted to talk, but of course they'd watch every mouthful going because they were all hungry.
So would you go in your tent to get away from them, or could you get away from them?
Well, they'd usually go about dusk. They'd leave about then.
Yeah, because they
terribly hard workers. They work all day long. And
they had to get home.
They had to get home. But
One time, Lloyd was trying to show an old lady minding her sheep, trying to show her on the whiskey, on the rye bottle where Canada was.
You know that one that has a map of the world on it? What is it? The Seagram.
Yeah.
It has a map of the world, and it said Canada. And I was telling her where we came from and so on. And she's out like this, so I showed her this whiskey bottle and I pointed to Canada and she said, no, she didn't know what a map was. They weren't offensive. Gypsies are the only problem if they come around.
Yeah,
they steal?
Oh, they steal.
If they came, we scooted out of there.
We just pack up and leave. That was all there was to it in the middle of the night or anything.
Were the gypsies that much? They were distinctive from the rest of the
town? Oh, yeah. Tell
in manner of dress?
Miles away, yeah.
Were the people generally kind and generous to you?
Oh yeah, very much so.
Yeah, and they weren't thieves, although one time my British air attaché was sleeping across the back seat of the car and we got up in the morning, his shoes were gone.
They were in a Land Rover. Mm-hmm. And it was summer and they had the sides down, so he slept across the back of it.
With his feet up there?
He was a great tall fellow anyway, and he had the one end, his feet were sticking out the other, so he took his shoes off, put them on the ground, woke up in the morning, and they weren't there. Our air attaché was going with him on the trip. I forgot where he slept. But anyway, this was quite a joke in the morning when he woke up. He had no shoes. And he was just dressed in shorts, you know, and a short sleeve shirt and this kind of thing. And the police, the military all came around, a whole squad of them, and very, very nasty about everything. So, here they camped in the middle of an ammunition depot.
Oh, was that it?
Yeah. Of the local airfield. They'd been reconnoitering this airfield.
No wonder they took
his shoes. Pulled in there for the night, the damn fools.
No wonder they took his
shoes. But this thing wasn't under guard. I mean, there wasn't any fence around it, but here they were. They hauled the two of them in front of the commandant of this airfield. Like a couple of common criminals. Really didn't know who they were. Dennis, of course, is the greatest joker in the world. He said, this commandant asked him, and he said, and who are you, Dag Garner, who was the group captain in the RAF. He said, who are you? He said, he summoned himself up to this full height, and he said, I am the air attaché of His Majesty's Embassy in Beltray. Dennison said to me, the guy looked at him, he said, boy, you're a great looker. This guy has no shoes on. Looks like a tramp. Fellow said, oh yeah. But I never had any worries about having anything stolen. Ever, because it's your old system that if anybody showed up with something they didn't own or couldn't justify, they'd obviously stolen it, and if anybody saw it, and later on a person got hauled in for having stolen it, and it was known that he knew that he had it, he'd be guilty too, you see.
Okay.
So there was no question of anybody stealing anything from you. They just couldn't. There was no... It was useful in that respect. Mm-hmm. But it's just the way their whole system works. Now, in a peasant society, that would be true even without
the communists,
because the peasant society is so closely knit.
Mm-hmm.
You have no privacy whatever under any circumstance, so that it would be the same among peasants as it was among the people in Belgrade.
Could you find out that Tito's domination was as strong in the countryside for the peasants as it was in the cities?
I don't know as we could tell. Their life wasn't affected very much by the whole thing. They had their flocks of pigs and sheep and chickens and goats, and they had their own plum trees and things like that. And made their
red peppers.
They grew red peppers there.
So it didn't really matter who was in Belgrade running things?
They had always had a hard existence there, and it wasn't easy, but I don't think their life was affected very much.
Though I should think, like in most communist regimes, the peasants tend to be stripped of their produce and whatever they seem to grow by any sort of autocratic regime.
There was an effort to do that, but nothing like as vicious as old Joe had in... They were...
I remember what he did to the Kulaks in the 1920s.
Yeah, well, that was terrible, but... Tito, I think, understood the situation better than Joe did.
Yeah.
And didn't push them that far.
Well, Tito was someone of the people, whereas Stalin, I think, was...
He was...
Professional revolutionary.
Yeah, that's right. He had no touch with him at all.
Yeah.
No, But then by the same token, we were gone at first light. Even if it got light at 4 o'clock in the morning, we had to be gone because as soon as the light came up, these have peasants around all over while you were trying to get washed and shaved.
With all their animals.
And all their animals, they'd come and bring a donkey in with them. That was no problem, you know, those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
So we did it almost a fugitive sort of existence, trying to find a place to hide at night and then get away before we were found in the morning.
The idea was to try and not be placed.
Well, partly from the point of view of the security forces, but also from the point of view of just the plain peasants pestering you. They didn't really do anything wrong. It was you didn't want them over. They'd stand between you and your stove, and you'd turn around, and there'd be another one between you and the tent, and this kind of thing. They just didn't understand anybody wanting any privacy, you know.
Just curious.
Well, you were an extreme oddity to them, weren't you?
Oh, indeed, we were. Oh, yeah. Very much so. The limousine, the car was, you know, that was enough to... Well, now, we totaled this up, and we figured that we spent an average of about 7 days a month traveling on field trips. Now, that may not sound like a lot, but when you take 30 days leave a year out of there, and... All the days we normally were in Belgrade for national days, for Yugoslav tours and so on, which sometimes went up to 10 days, and conferences in Trieste and Athens and Vienna and so on. By the time you took all those out, this was a very high number, and much more than I think anybody else ever did.
I was going to ask you about the assistant attaché,
He used to tour, never alone, but with either the American or British air attachés. But he had got disenchanted when he first got there from not having any replies from home on his work, and he did relatively very little of it.
The system hadn't improved. You mentioned last day when you were in Ottawa that you would often... write to these people and to try and bridge the gap that their own people had formed.
No, it hadn't improved at all. So he became disenchanted, but nevertheless, particularly the British would like him to go along because...
another set of eyes, nothing else.
Yeah, the air attaché's wife didn't travel.
No.
So, it's far better to be two people than one because I wouldn't want to travel alone.
Oh, Dick and Eleanor did a few trips on the Dalmatian coast.
Oh, yeah, well, that was just luxuriating on the sand. That was what that was. There weren't any airfields on the Dalmatian coast.
See, sometimes that happens.
Sometimes, that was what that was. But he was traveling up the Dalmatian coast one time in the wintertime, before they built the big road. It was only one vehicle wide in some places.
Mm-hmm.
Straight up and straight down. And they had enough,
down to the Adriatic,
enough flat tires that they couldn't move. And they sat there for 3 days before another vehicle came along.
Indeed.
And they got a ride in and took some tires with them and got them repaired in the next town.
Wouldn't like having a house on that road. I mean, wouldn't
enjoy it. Lots of ox carts and things like that passed, but no vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was going to say that on field trips I was very lucky. Because the ambassador had to approve all the trips and sign your claim when you got back. We could claim for our expenses on these trips, like gasoline and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to sign them. So it was in almost every embassy that I knew, the ambassador was very sticky about what he would approve and wouldn't approve because... he was afraid he might get criticized, I think, back home for having approved too many trips. A lot of them didn't see the value in any traveling around the country. Mm-hmm. However, my ambassador was a bit different than most of them. He said, when I started asking him about permission to go, he'd say, he said to me, well, he said, now look, he said, don't come and ask me before you go. He said, tell me when you get back. So that was all I wanted. I was absolutely in the clear.
Well, you said that he would have to justify the expenses. Would they come out of external affairs funds?
No, National Defense. The way National Defense had it written, and your expenses must be approved by the ambassador. Mm-hmm. Well, otherwise, who was going to approve it? You approve it yourself, because that's all it would be. You see, it was a safeguard so you weren't running up a bill.
Yeah.
Like Menard saying he'd been down to visit the unit, and his sergeant won't type out the claim because he said he knows I haven't been there.
Did I already tell him that one?
Yeah.
And a few other Menard stories, too.
Yeah, oh, gosh.
Quite the fellow. In point of fact, I should tell you this. I was talking to a Colonel Wilkins, who was an engineer, and he was saying that he went to a staff college with Menard in 1942, and I think he called him a blustering bullshit, excuse the language, but that's his terminology for Menard. Didn't think much of him then or later. That's when Menard was a major, I think.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Some of the wives went along, as we mentioned. The U.S. wives didn't go along. And the U.S. officers always stayed in hotels, so what they were doing was, I think, again, a good deal more subject to surveillance than I was.
Mm-hmm.
Because once they knew we were in the area, then I think all the units were alerted, you see.
Yeah.
And they usually knew where I was because they'd always write down your telephone, or at least your vehicle license number when you went past the police post or anything, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So they knew where I'd been when I got back to Belgrade. Probably the liaison section could tell me where I'd been. Mm-hmm. But they didn't know where I was going before I got there, you see.
That's right.
So this was whereas if you're traveling in hotels, they know right away that you're in that town. And it's a good deal less satisfactory. I was very lucky in that I had a wife that would travel with me and put up with all this traveling around.
A camp, too.
In camp.
Most wives don't like camping.
No, there were conferences. No.
Oh, I didn't mind.
I didn't care for it. It wasn't a pleasure at all. It was just...
No, but it was better than going to hotels.
Better than going to a hotel, I was all.
Some of the hotels were all right, but some of them, you get into bed and the sheets were damp.
Moving too much.
Yeah. You know, it amazes me because, you know, I talk about DDT now as though it's something that's, you know, you get a whiff of it, it's going to kill you. We had a great big can of powdered DDT. We would plaster it all over ourselves and all over the bed, sheet under you and a sheet on top and so on, and then crawl into bed with all that on you all night in order to keep the bed bugs away.
That was in Italy.
And Greece.
Oh, yeah.
And so on, yeah, in Italy, in rural areas.
Safe camp. I mean, doesn't the
skin... Well, it never ever affected me.
Yeah,
just kept the bugs out. Never thought anything of it. But,
Madame Niskanen, the Finnish ambassador's wife, used to carry plastic sheets. And she
used to carry plastic sheets. I can't fancy sleeping between plastic sheets.
You would just sweat.
However, there was an order of battle conference that they had. And first of all, it was in Trieste, and then they had it in Vienna once Trieste folded up. And that was once a year, and there would be analysts from the States and from the UK and Canada.
Just the three?
Oh, yeah, just the three, that's all. And then there was the British and American analysts who worked at the intelligence in Trieste, and they had an intelligence headquarters in Vienna. They would be there, so there'd be maybe 20, 30 people at one of these conferences.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the headquarters had several people there. And they would deal systematically with, it lasted about 3 days, and mm-hmm. they would deal systematically with the various portions of the Army. This was Army only, not Air Force and Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And discuss it all, and all the attachés would be there, the British and American, myself from Belgrade, or the assistants.
Mm-hmm.
Very often it was only the assistants from the other two.
Would it ever be a case that both would be there?
I don't think we ever had either one of the attachés, American or British, at the conference. There were only the assistant attachés, weren't they?
Why would that be?
Well, because the assistant attaché knew what he was doing, and the attaché didn't.
Yeah.
And besides that, in a big embassy like that, the ambassador is very inclined to say, no, no, I want you here, either for show or for in case something comes up and needs advice or something. So they were more or less pinned down. Well, you see, we didn't have any fish to fry or anything out there. We didn't have any problems. So I was free. And on the other hand, the other assistants were the people who really knew the score. And I dealt practically all the time with the other two assistants rather than the two attachés, although I got on with the attachés longer.
Well, tell me this. Would you be of the same rank of, say, of the assistants?
No, they were majors, and I was a full colonel.
I understand, I see. And what would the other attachés be, the American?
They were all full colonel.
That was the general rank?
Yes, general throughout the world it is. Although some nations raise it above that, they'll make them a major general or something.
Or a brigadier.
And these conferences, towards the end, they used to say to me, well, why don't you stay at home and just send Elizabeth to the conference? She knows more about it than you do anyway. She'd be there, but shopping while I was at the conference.
Oh, boy.
You like
my
the
time
amusement?
Out.
I take it there wasn't much shopping in Belgrade.
Oh, no.
Oh, nothing there at all.
Other than black bread and a few brags.
Yeah.
But I hear tell that Vienna wasn't exactly too cosmopolitan at that time. I mean, it was rather closely, it was still partitioned, I suppose.
Yeah, it was. Yes. Yeah, we had to go through the Russian zone to get there.
Yeah. So it wasn't the pleasant city that we know of it today and then, say, 100 years ago. I mean, it wasn't the gate
Vienna. Oh, it was, it was better than a lot of other places.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was heaven to get out there.
I think you've seen the film The Third Man.
Yes.
Is that a good representation of what Vienna was like?
I don't know, really, whether it was or not. I couldn't say. I couldn't go that far.
Yeah.
And a strange thing happened. I was visiting Trieste one time as a lieutenant colonel, and I got in late at night, well, about 8 o'clock or so, and visiting the Americans first, and this was when I was back in Ottawa on my other job.
Mm-hmm.
You mean Vienna, don't you?
Vienna.
You said Vienna.
Oh, Vienna. And I got in late at night and checked in, and they said, here's an officer to look after you for the evening, you see. Americans are awfully good at that, you know. They don't leave you on your own around at all. So he said, what do you want to do for the night? Well, I said, first of all, I want to go into a bar there and have a drink. We're staying at the, not Soccer's, the other one, the Bristol. Have a drink, and then we can talk about it. And we got talking. Well, first of all, he got the drink, and guy came in playing a zither in the corner, you see. You can imagine what he was playing. And I'd never even heard the tune before. I said, what's the name of that tune? The guy said, he was a captain in the pro. You know, he said, say, buddy, you kidding? I still didn't know what it was, but later I found out what the tune was.
Well, I think the film was in sort of vogue at that
time. Oh, it was very popular, and the music was, wherever you went, you heard it from then on. But so I said, look, you don't really have to feel pinned down here for the night, Bishop, because I know Vienna. He said, oh, do you? I said, good. You beat it just like that. What a fellow. But anyway, it was a great place to stay.
Well, these conferences, would they accomplish an awful lot? Like, would you, the three of you get together and really let your hair down and really...
They were quite frank and everything, and there would be quite strong arguments developed there among, not so much among the attachés, but between the attachés and the Home Office. Now, I didn't used to get into those arguments myself because I knew the Home Office had sources from my previous experience that we didn't have. And when they were dogmatic on something, I would only assume that, well, they knew it from a source with which we weren't familiar. Whereas the other two assistant attachés, I don't think any of them ever, although they changed over while I was there, I don't think any of them ever really knew that background. And they used to argue when there was no basis for them to argue, you see. That was just a weakness they had to put up with, and the people in the Home Office couldn't explain why they argued that way. But when they'd come out with the order of battle, then there would be a printed order of battle normally, agreed by everybody. And they come out with it, usually it was the Home Office that decided what would be there. But some very irate assistant attachés, namely Ian Ramsey. But,
was he the American or the British?
No, the British. He was a Scotchman.
Scottish chief. Oh, Scottish chief was quite a good argument.
Boy, what a temper he had.
Would they, the discussions that take place at the conferences, would it be more than the information that you would send back to Ottawa or to Washington or to London? Like, would there be anything, would it really be necessary to go to this extent and have a meeting? Other than reassuring those in the field that there's someone back there listening and interested in what you're doing?
Yes, there was. The people in the Home Office, for example, should have had everything that you saw and knew. And if the fellow from the Home Office said, now look, we all agreed that so-and-so unit has moved from A to B, so-and-so has moved from C to D, and so on and so on, surely this third unit now must have moved to so-and-so. And when you got into that kind of an argument, then the people from the field might say, well, okay, I haven't visited that, but so-and-so and so-and-so, I don't think there's reasons why I don't think they ever moved that unit there. I think they moved this unit there.
So there the information that you wouldn't have in an official report that you would
that's
have...
That's right. You had a background which the person in the field didn't... the person in the Home Office didn't have. And that was more or less the way it would work out. The real meat came out of the field people, it seemed. The people in the Home Office, they just had what you told them, and that was it, and whatever other sources they had. But the discussions very often would be between the attachés themselves and on you know, what was there. And one would say, well, he'd reported back that there was an artillery unit in this town. Another would come back and say, boy, I went all over that town last week and I couldn't find any artillery unit there. So
points of differences would come out.
Yeah, well, yeah, a lot of it. That's what all the arguing was about. Otherwise, they wouldn't have taken 3 days.
So let me ask you one thing, and I think we should end soon. It's getting late, and we've been talking for some time. You mentioned how important before it was when you were in Ottawa to maintain close and good communications with the attaché in the field.
Yeah.
Now, here you are in the field. Were you getting good cooperation with Ottawa?
First long I did.
Yeah.
As long as Norm Cuthbert was the DMI and Joe Sarantis was the had replaced me, I had no problems at all.
You felt that what you were sending back was being used?
Yeah, I had good support there. So for the for my first period there, I was quite happy.
Norm having been previously the military attaché in Ankara.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so I had a good start there in that respect.
It deteriorated after, I take it.
After that, it wasn't nearly so good. Now, if we just, well, you're... We also attended one conference on Bulgaria in Athens.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I was invited to attend that conference because our famous trip through the country where we got through all of both zones at each end, one was 200 kilometers and the other was about 50 kilometers. Which nobody had been in before.
So you had a special insight to
that? I had a special in on all that. And,
There would have been two, I think, then Canadians involved in that conference, the one from Bulgaria and you from Yugoslavia.
Well, we didn't have anybody in Bulgaria.
I see.
There were British and Americans who were there, and strangely enough, we had a fellow from Ottawa there whom I got going on this subject of studying where barracks were as opposed to, or keeping track of them as well as army units.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up with a barrack room study of, or a barrack study of Bulgaria, which had rather shaken the British and Americans, so he was invited to come too. So he came, where did we meet him? Trieste? Jack?
I think we must
have. We brought him into Belgrade, he stayed with us a few days there, and then we all drove down to Athens together and attended the conference there. And then I had arranged for a leave from Athens, and we took a cruise around the eastern Mediterranean and went out from the Piraeus, which of course was my own expense.
Rather nice.
Yeah, it worked out very well. Well, so much for that. I now wanted to deal with, or next deal with, the intelligence that became available from the field trips. That is what I really saw and did. We've probably covered some of that already.
Oh, I actually wanted to ask you a bit more about that, so that's good. You're going to bring that up.
Yeah. At least what we found and what value it was. The results of the field trips were they produced. That was the next thing I had on the agenda.
Okay, well, this is the longest session we've had yet.
Is it?
Are you bearing up under it well?
Well, I might as well.
Matter of fact, I'm glad you showed me where the washroom was last week, because I'm really happy to be here right now.
Yeah.
Excuse me.